Have you ever wondered if your memories are more than just electrical signals in your brain? What if they're actually written down, noted by a silent scribe on the very pages of your DNA?
That's such a fascinating question. For me, as someone who works with stories, the idea that our life experiences, the joys, the traumas, could leave a physical chemical mark on our
Yeah.
genes, it's profound. It changes how I think about character, about legacy, about what we carry with us.
Exactly. It's this idea that our genome isn't just a static blueprint we're born with, but more like a dynamic script that our experiences are constantly editing. And that's what we're exploring today, the incredible intersection of memory and epigenetics.
Right, the idea that our environment, our choices, everything we live through can essentially add footnotes to our genetic code, telling certain genes to speak up and others to stay quiet. It's mind-bending stuff.
It really is. We're going to unravel how these epigenetic marks get made, how they help solidify our memories, turning fleeting moments into lasting parts of who we are. And we'll even touch on the controversial, almost science fiction idea. Could these marks, these echoes of our experiences, be passed down through generations?
That's the part that really gets me, this idea that we might be carrying the whispers of our ancestors' lives within our own cells. It completely reframes the conversation about nature versus nurture. It's not a battle, it's a collaboration. I can't wait to dive in.
So let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. When we say our experiences are adding footnotes or marks to our DNA, what does that actually look like on a molecular level? Is it like a tiny little pen writing on the double helix?
That's a great way to put it, and in a way it is. The most well understood of these marks is a process called DNA methylation. It sounds complicated, but the concept is surprisingly straightforward. Imagine specific points on your DNA, these little docking stations, and an enzyme comes along and attaches a tiny molecule, a methyl group.
Okay, a methyl group. So it's not changing the letters of the code, the A, T, C, and G. It's just adding an accessory.
Precisely. It's like putting a sticky note on a page of a book that says, shh, don't read this part out loud. That methyl tag often tells the cellular machinery to ignore that specific gene. It effectively silences it, or at least turns its volume way down without altering the underlying genetic sequence at all.
Wow. Okay, so how does the brain use that silencing mechanism to build a memory? When I learn a new fact, is there a little enzyme in my hippocampus that gets a command to go stick a note on a gene?
It's almost exactly like that. When you're learning, when you're forming a memory, certain neurons are firing like crazy. That intense activity is the trigger. It activates specific enzymes. One key player is called DNMT3A2, and they are, in fact, dispatched to add or even remove these methyl marks on what we call plasticity genes.
Plasticity genes, so genes that are specifically for learning.
Yeah, in a sense, they're the genes that code for the proteins needed to build stronger connections between neurons. Think of it as the construction crew. When you learn something, you need to reinforce the pathway in your brain. These genes are the blueprints for the materials. Epigenetics, through methylation, is the foreman telling the crew which blueprints to use and which to put away.
So a new strong memory is literally physically built. And these methyl marks are the instructions ensuring the construction is stable and long-lasting. It's not just an echo, it's an architectural change.
It is. The memory goes from being a short-term electrical whisper to a long-term, structurally supported piece of information. Studies have shown that if you block these enzymes, long-term memories just don't form properly. The initial experience is there, but it fades away because the brain never got the epigenetic go-ahead to carve it into the structure.
That's incredible. It also makes me think about, well, about forgetting or about cognitive decline as we age. Is it possible that process starts to break down? The foreman gets a bit sloppy, maybe?
That's a huge area of research right now. The evidence points to yes. As we get older, the expression of that key enzyme, DNMT3A2, naturally declines. And with it, the ability to make those crucial epigenetic edits seems to weaken. The scribe's hand gets a little shaky, and the ability to write new, lasting memories just isn't what it used to be.
A shaky hand. That's such a poignant and slightly terrifying image. But it makes me wonder about the opposite end of the spectrum. What happens when an experience isn't fading, but is seared into your mind? A trauma, for instance. Does the scribe's hand become too firm? Does it press so hard the ink bleeds through the page?
That is precisely what the evidence suggests. If age-related decline is the scribe getting tired, trauma is the scribe being handed an indelible permanent marker and a command to write in bold capital letters. The emotional arousal, the flood of stress hormones like cortisol that comes with a traumatic event, it's like a massive system-wide alert for the epigenetic machinery.
So it's not just a psychological echo, it's a physical, an engraving. The foreman isn't just giving instructions, he's screaming them through a bullhorn.
Through a bullhorn and telling the crew to use quick-drying cement instead of water, the methylation patterns laid down in response to intense fear conditioning are incredibly robust and stable. They are designed, from a survival standpoint, to be difficult to erase. The gene that says be afraid of this gets silenced, or another that says react strongly to this trigger gets locked in the on position.
Which makes perfect sense for survival. You want to remember the lion's den. But in modern life, when the lion is an abstract memory, that system works against us.
It works profoundly against us. It's the biological basis for why PTSD can be so intractable. The memory isn't just in the mind. It's a persistent structural change in how the neurons read their own DNA. The alert system is permanently switched on.
Okay, but this is leaning very dark. What about the other side of that coin? What about profound joy? The birth of a child, falling in love. Moments of pure elation. Does the scribe write those memories with the same permanent ink? Or is our biology fundamentally biased towards threat?
That is such a crucial question. And honestly, the research is still playing catch up. For a long time, the focus has been on fear and stress because, frankly, the biological pathways are a sledgehammer. They're easier to trigger and trace in a lab setting.
Right. It's easier to scare a mouse than to make it fall in love.
Exactly. But we are starting to see that positive, rewarding experiences also create lasting epigenetic changes, things like pair bonding, maternal attachment. They lay down their own unique signatures. It might involve different enzymes or modifications to the histones, the protein spools that DNA wraps around, rather than just methylation. Mm-hmm. It might be a bit different kind of ink.
A different kind of ink. I like that. So it's not just a ledger of threats and warnings. It could also be a book of poetry. Our DNA could be carrying the chronicle of our connections, our triumphs.
I believe so. It suggests that what makes a memory stick isn't just the intensity of the emotion, but the type of emotion. It's the difference between a memory that serves as a warning and one that serves as a guidepost, pointing you back toward connection and reward. Both need to be durable, but they're written for very different reasons.
And that's the thing, isn't it? A guidepost. It has to be just as permanent as a warning, but for a completely different reason, it almost feels like. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our biology isn't just about survival, but about, well, about thriving. Finding our way back to the good stuff.
But what if those guideposts, or even the warnings, aren't as permanent as we think? What if the ink isn't indelible after all? What if every time we pull a memory off the shelf to look at it, we risk smudging it?
Oh, wow. So you're saying the act of remembering itself changes the memory?
That's a wild thought. We think of long-term memory as this stable archive, a logged vault.
It's not a vault. It's more like a library where you're allowed to write in the books. This is the whole idea of reconsolidation.
When you recall a memory, it doesn't just get viewed, it gets temporarily unlocked. It's brought back into your working memory, and in that state, it's vulnerable?
Vulnerable to what? To new information? To my current mood?
Mm-hmm.
To everything. It's open to manipulation. This is where the misinformation effect can creep in. You recall a childhood memory while someone tells you a slightly different version of the story, and your brain can accidentally edit your version with their details. The scribe gets a new instruction and just writes it in.
That is deeply unsettling. It makes your entire personal history feel negotiable, valuable, like it's written in pencil, not ink.
It can be, but think of the flip side. Think about the therapeutic potential. If a memory is vulnerable when it's recalled, what if you could use that? Imagine someone with PTSD recalling a traumatic memory, but doing it in a completely safe, calm, therapeutic environment.
You're saying the context, the new, safe context, gets written into the memory?
It can weaken the emotional charge. The next time that memory is retrieved, it comes back with a little less of that fear, a little less of that arousal. You're not erasing the memory, but you're teaching the scribe to use a lighter touch when rewriting that chapter. You're lowering the volume on the bullhorn.
So is every memory susceptible to this? My memory of what I had for breakfast this morning and the memory of my graduation, are they equally evitable?
That's where it gets complicated. And the research is still, you know, it's debating the fine print. The evidence seems to suggest that very strong, maybe overtrained memories are more resistant. They're less likely to go into that reconsolidation process. It's like some books in the library are in a glass case and you can only look, not touch.
So there's a hierarchy of stability. That makes me feel a little better. But stepping back from all of this, from the scribe and the ink and the bullhorn, It feels like the big takeaway is that we're not just passive observers of our own genetic story. We have some agency.
We have tremendous agency. And it's not just in these high-stakes therapeutic settings, simple lifestyle changes, things we all know we should do. Exercise, a healthy diet, managing stress, even just doing memory exercises. That UCLA study showed real cognitive improvements in just 2 weeks.
It's like we're in charge of the scribe's working conditions. We can give them the best tools, the best environment, keep their hands steady, or we can create a chaotic workplace where mistakes are made.
That's the perfect way to put it. We are the curators of our own internal library. The conversation started with this mind-bending idea of memories being written on our DNA, and it's ending with this incredibly empowering idea that we get to be the head librarian.
From the molecular to the profoundly personal, it changes everything. It's not just about what we remember, but how we choose to live with those memories and how that choice physically shapes who we become next. It's been an incredible journey.
It truly has. It leaves you with the sense that our life isn't just a story that's been written. It's one we're constantly co-authoring, right down to the footnotes on our genes. Thanks as always for listening.